President Obama is due to speak in Cedar Falls in a couple hours. This hour, the politics of the president's new broadband initiative. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The president will outline his plans and hold up Cedar Falls internet access, run by the local utilities, as a model. In just a moment, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest will preview the president's talk. Then our analysts Dennis Goldford of Drake University and Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College will weigh in on the president's talk, as well as other news from Capitol Hill, and survey the political repercussions of the Paris attacks. Politics Day, just ahead. First, this news. It's Politics Day here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a couple of hours, President Obama will be in Cedar Falls. He'll outline his plans for broadband in this country and hold up Cedar Falls internet access, run by the local utilities, as a model for the country. In just a moment, we'll be joined by our regular analysts, Dennis Goldford of Drake University and Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. They'll weigh in on the president's talk, as well as other news from Capitol Hill, and survey the political repercussions of the Paris attacks. But first, this morning, I spoke with White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest about the president's talk this afternoon in Cedar Falls. Josh Earnest, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing fine. So, what does the president want to change?
What the president wants to change is he wants to make sure that we are expanding access to the internet to communities all across the country, and specifically we want to lift up efforts that have been undertaken by citizens in Cedar Falls to make sure that citizens in their community have high-speed, reliable access to the internet. And they did that by essentially banding together and creating a public utility.
Mm-hmm.
And what that did was that introduced some competition into this, that so often people have to they rely on their cable companies that sometimes are operating with a virtual monopoly. And, by introducing this this public effort, they've got reliable, cost-effective, high-speed access to the internet that's good for the economy. It certainly is good for people's quality of life. It's a good way for us to think creatively about what we can do to expand broadband internet access into communities large and small all across the country.
Mm-hmm. Unlike most of Iowa and most of the cities across the U.S., the Cedar Falls Utilities runs the high-speed broadband fiber with incredible speeds. Iowa's first gigabyte city is in Cedar Falls. So is the president trying to address this common frustration, Josh, that if we're not happy with our media, our internet company, most people don't have a lot of choices. Is this the frustration that's being addressed?
Yeah, and that's exactly what this is. This is about giving people more choices and more opportunities to create some competition in the market and force service providers to do a better job of providing better service, more reliable service. And in some cases, even cheaper service. And there are significant benefits for the local economy. If you're running a small business and you want to have access to markets all around the world, you need to have reliable, fast access to the internet. And you're going to make a decision about where you're going to locate your business about making sure that you have access to high-speed internet access. You know, this is the other way to think about this. Is this is a new way for us to think about infrastructure in this country. You know, we talk a lot about infrastructure being, a modern airport or a highway that doesn't have potholes in it or a bridge that's been resurfaced and expanded to handle the amount of local traffic that it services every day. Another way to think about this is internet access. All of them have direct consequences for the economy. All of them are going to have a direct impact on decisions that are made by businesses on a daily basis about where to locate their company. And so this is a new and an interesting way for us to take a look at how to address this challenge of our infrastructure and to think about what we can do to provide more citizens and more businesses high-speed, reliable access to the internet.
How will this be implemented, Josh, through the Federal Communications Commission?
Well, the idea would be that essentially there are ways for the federal government, through a variety of funding mechanisms, to support local efforts. So in Cedar Falls, this is essentially the community got together and decided this is something that they wanted to do in their community. And there's a role for the federal government to play in terms of supporting citizens in other communities that want to do something very similar.
Mm-hmm. Now, some will say this is another case of federal bureaucrats meddling in local affairs, that the federal government has no role telling states or local municipalities how to run their affairs. Respond to that.
This is really an opportunity for us, for the federal government, to support citizens who want to make a choice for themselves. This is not a government mandate. This is the federal government coming in and saying, to local communities, hey, you want better broadband access. This is something that you're trying to work on your own to try to create some competition in your community for internet access. We're willing to come in and help you, to support you financially as you try to organize together to do exactly that. So this is not constraining citizens from making choices. This is actually empowering citizens to make more choices in a way that's good for their quality of life and in a way that's good for their community and good for businesses in their community.
Now, of course, the giant telecoms, AT&T, Time Warner Cable, Mediacom, have extensively lobbied around the country to ensure that they don't have that much competition or have to compete directly with these types of municipal projects. How much opposition does the president anticipate from existing cable giants?
Well, I would imagine that there might be some companies that wouldn't like this competition. As I mentioned, there are some cable companies in some communities across the country that essentially operate as a monopoly, that they don't face competition. And that's one of the reasons that citizens are getting together, is to introduce competition. And this is a free market principle that Republicans often cite as a way to benefit local communities, which is to introduce a little competition and force companies to compete. And this will drive down prices, drive up reliability, drive up service, improve service. And this is something that the federal government should be supportive of.
Now, I understand the Cedar Falls Utilities received funds previously from the Broadband Initiatives Program run by the Ag Department's Rural Utilities Service. And this was part of the 2009 stimulus package. Now, we hear from the White House it's a program that the president wants to renew. But the Government Accountability Office last year deemed this program to be in trouble. Several projects were canceled. It was decried by Republicans as wasteful. Why would it work better this time? Is there money connected to this initiative?
There is money connected to this initiative. There's also money that would be through a new initiative called Broadband USA that would be run through the Department of Commerce. And for all of the critics, I mean, this is the reason the president's traveling to Cedar Falls. For those people who are critical of the program, we just say, look at Cedar Falls. This is a community that's gotten together and, with the support of the federal government, has brought high-speed broadband access to a small community in Iowa. And they have used it to great effect to improve the quality of life and to improve the business environment in their community. There is faster broadband access in Cedar Falls than there is in Washington, D.C. Faster broadband access that's available in Cedar Falls than places like New York and San Francisco. There is a real benefit to citizens getting together and organizing to try to introduce some competition in the market, and that's something that we should support, and that's exactly what the president's going to be talking about today.
I know we don't have much time, but I wanted to ask you how this initiative might help spur high-speed internet access in rural areas, which are lagging behind the cities. Our governor, Branstad, is planning to push for better mobile broadband in the agricultural parts of the state.
Well, there is some resistance among some companies, I think understandably, private companies, who are resistant to sort of investing in smaller communities because there are a smaller number of customers in smaller communities. So again, this is an opportunity for the federal government to support the efforts of citizens in local communities to make their own investment in these kinds of projects and create that kind of competition that will force the companies to compete for those customers in a way that will drive up reliability, drive up their service, and drive down costs.
Josh Earnest, before we go, I want to ask you this.
Sure.
This is the president's first time in Iowa, I believe, since the night before Election Day back in 2012, when he was reelected to office. Before this latest midterm, Iowa had a split congressional delegation, three Democrats and three Republicans. I wonder if the president sees his decreasing popularity and his policies as part of the reason that now 5 of 6 members of Congress from Iowa are Republican. He said his policies were on the ballot, right?
Yeah, well, Ben, I guess you could make the case the fact that the president hasn't been in in Iowa for a couple of years hasn't been good for Democratic candidates who are running on the ballot in Iowa. So the president feels like it's time to get back to Iowa and start making the case about all the important things that his administration has done to follow through on the promises that he made when he campaigned extensively in Iowa in 2007 and in 2008 and again in 2012. So the president's got a lot of good friends in Iowa. The president's really looking forward to getting back to a state that is close to his heart. You know, the president's victory on caucus night in Iowa 7 years ago now, I can't believe it's been that long, but 7 years ago now, was really the launching pad for his national campaign. And the president would not be in office today and would not be flying on Air Force One if Iowa Democrats had not spoken so loudly and vividly on caucus night in early January of 2008 to put the president on the path of being the Democratic nominee. So the president's excited about getting back to Iowa. He's got a lot of friends there he hasn't seen in a while.
Looking
forward to talking about the kind of accomplishments and the kind of progress we can continue to make in his last 2 years in office.
Quickly, who will be with him on the stage?
I understand that the Secretary of Commerce, Penny Pritzker, will also be traveling with the president today. This Broadband USA initiative will be operated by the Department of Commerce. But I expect that there will be some local officials who will be in town to meet the president as well, and the president's looking forward to seeing him.
Not the governor.
I don't know what the governor's schedule is today. I know that traditionally when the president travels to a state, the governor's invited to at least greet the president on the tarmac when he arrives. I'm not sure if Governor Branstad's schedule will accommodate that today, but we certainly hope so.
White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest, thank you for your time.
No problem, Ben. Good to talk to you, man.
It's a conversation I had with White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest earlier today. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Day. Joining me now, Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Dennis Goldford, Professor of Political Science at Drake University, also the Flansburg Fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. Dennis in our Des Moines studio. Hi.
Hi, guys. Glad to be here.
And Wayne by phone. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Ben.
Let's reach out to our listeners and ask, what do you think of this initiative? Would be interesting if our Cedar Falls listeners would chime in and tell us what you think of your broadband access through the local utilities. Should it be held up as a model for the nation, as the president is doing today? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Dennis, let me start with you. React to the president's new initiative, this Broadband USA initiative being announced this afternoon by the president in Cedar Falls, and what Josh Earnest just talked about.
Well, at one level, you can certainly say that this is part of infrastructure, that in the modern world, you need good, reliable broadband access to be connected to the world of culture and politics and as well as commerce and things like that. So it's absolutely necessary. This is something presumably the president, even with a Congress controlled by the other party, can pursue. But as I listened to this and thought about it, I kept thinking of the term small ball. And you've had presidents saying that they didn't want to engage in small ball. They wanted to have big, major sorts of things. And I think back to the glee and the enthusiasm on the part of President Obama's supporters when he got elected to begin with in 2008. And if you said, okay, the meaning of the Obama presidency is going to be extending broadband internet access, I don't think that's what they were thinking back then. But it shows, I think, the kind of policy that he can attempt to pursue in much more straitened and restricted circumstances.
Wayne, is that the way you see it? Is a small ball by the president?
Well, I kind of look at this as an interesting question of how one defines dangerous regulation. Is it more dangerous to have state laws forbidding cities from providing internet or broadband internet, or is it more dangerous having federal rules making it difficult for states to prohibit cities from providing broadband? And so I think there's an interesting question here, and how this is resolved will have major implications.
Mm. I want to play a little bit of audio from a new video that the White House put out. This is from President Obama himself, and we posted the link on our Facebook page, because it's really quite interesting to see the president stride into the Oval Office, sit on his desk in the Oval Office, lean against it, I should say, with his iPad, and point out a bar graph that has Seoul, South Korea, and Paris on a bar graph next to Cedar Falls. Let's listen to a bit of it.
So you've got Seoul, South Korea, Hong Kong, Tokyo, Paris. These cities all have really fast access to the internet because they've made the investments in broadband. Now, here's what's interesting. Right next to it, you got Cedar Falls, Iowa. Now, Cedar Falls isn't a really big place. You only got 40,000 people in Cedar Falls. But the reason they can compete with these other world cities is because citizens got together and made the investment to bring competition in and make sure that internet speeds were just as fast there as anywhere else.
So here's the president tapping into some common frustration, Wayne, about having to rely on media monopolies or near monopolies for what has become a vital way to go about commerce and communication.
Well, I think that resonates with most of us, that when we experience internet delays, we always ask why and are always looking for what will provide better access.
Okay. Well, what do you think in this larger picture of what the president is doing, Dennis Goldford, these drop-in on states to push proposals, visits? We're told, I think Josh Earnest, used the expression executive action there in this case as well, something that has become more frequent since the Republican took control of the midterms. You see a pattern?
Well, the president is trying to use a phrase that occurred in past administrations, trying to remain relevant. In many ways, of course, the fact that the Congress now is totally controlled by Republicans doesn't change the fact that he was pretty well stymied in what he wanted to do by Republican control of the House of Representatives ever since January of 2011. But it's the attempt, I think, on the part of the president to pursue an agenda of his own that's free from the concern about re-election either on his part or re-election on the part of other Democrats during his remaining term of office. But again, under conditions in which he's severely limited in terms of what he can do legislatively.
Now, I want to follow up with a question that was emailed to me earlier today by Tom in Iowa City. And I commented with Josh Earnest about who would be meeting the president in Cedar Falls today. And Tom in Iowa City writes, how big a snub is it that Branstad won't be in Cedar Falls today for Obama's visit? Is it unprecedented? It keeps getting mentioned on the radio, but I don't know how significant it is, Tom writes. And we have just called the governor's office and indeed confirmed that the governor is in his office all day and will not be seeing Obama. So, Wayne, is that unprecedented, our listener wants to know?
Oh, I don't think it's unprecedented. What strikes me, though, about what Obama is doing, he's going to states with Republican governors in states that are doing things that he wants to do. He went to Tennessee with his free community college, free tuition to community colleges. Now he's coming to Iowa. And in these states, states with Republican governors, they're doing things that he wants done. I think that's an interesting thing, and I can see where Branstad would find it very difficult to attend.
So and Mara Liasson pointed out that in our newscast at the top of the hour, it seems to be sort of the president taking a Republican governor's idea and sort of stealing the fire, Dennis? Is that the way you see it?
Well, to some extent. I mean, this president has always, always, always wanted to work with the other party. They've just not been willing to do so except on their terms. And his continuing to want to work with them has frustrated people in his own party. But again, under the conditions of his last 2 years when lame duckitude, so to speak, has really kicked in since the midterms, you've got to work with what you've got. And if you can try to say that, look, we've got areas where we can agree, even if it's not the sort of major foreign policy macroeconomic issues, but it's something as lower level but still important as broadband internet access, that gives them an opportunity to do so.
Here's a statement from Broadband for America. Now, don't confuse that with the initiative the president has put forward, Broadband USA. This is Broadband for America, and these words from co-chairs, former Senator John Sununu and former Representative Harold Ford, Jr., And Broadband for America describes itself as a broad coalition of internet and cable providers, as well as nonprofits dedicated to expanding internet access. This landed in my email box a couple hours ago. Broadband for America strongly agrees with President Obama that expanding access to high-speed broadband is critical to supporting innovation and economic mobility for all Americans. Ushered in under President Bill Clinton, our current light, tough regulatory approach has led to massive private investment that has helped deliver faster internet speeds to more Americans. But President Obama is risking the success we have witnessed by advocating for the reclassification of broadband as a Title II public utility, unprecedented government interference that would stifle private investment, hinder innovation, and undermine the growth of internet, in an email from Broadband for America. So I guess we can say, gentlemen, that the fight over broadband has started, if it hadn't started before. And people can say one of the battles or one of the starting places was Cedar Falls, Wayne.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think this is interesting because Obama is previewing all sorts of things for his State of the Union address. And it'll be very interesting. It's interesting that he's picked Iowa for one of what I think will be a major item. One of the major items in the address.
Now, today we heard in our news, too, House Republicans driving toward a vote on overturning President Obama's controversial immigration actions, their executive action, some legislation worth nearly $40 billion. As part of that legislation, Republicans pushing provisions to gut the president's immigration directives. Dennis, all bark, or can these moves have any teeth?
Well, it depends upon what requires congressional funding and what doesn't. I mean, certain kinds of things that the president has wanted to do in terms of his own executive authority are self-funding. I think there's some aspect of the immigration institutional framework that allows for that. But again, for Republicans, I think one of their strategies is to articulate their positions, vote on them, dare the president to veto them, and be ready to hang these votes around the candidates in 2016.
Wayne, anything to add to that on the actions against
some of the moderate Republicans in the House vote? And it's unlikely, I think, that this bill will get the 60 votes that it needs to get through the Senate. So I think it's very unlikely that the bill will even get to the president's desk. So I think I would agree with Dennis that it's mainly give people an opportunity to state their positions.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, what else do you see as this, well, new Congress got underway last week? Any other points you're watching out for?
Well, it's interesting that their very first bill they were concerned about was the Keystone Pipeline. And, of course, that remains controversial, and the president has said he would veto that. But of all the things going on, that seemed to be the number one issue for Republicans, which I found curious.
Mm-hmm. Why curious?
Because of all the things we've got to deal with in terms of problems with regard to at least setting out a budget for the first time in a number of years, defense policy, generally, as well as in the light of the recent events we'll talk about shortly. There are a lot more important things right now, it appears, than simply the Keystone Pipeline.
Okay, we'll come back and continue politics Wednesday with Dennis Goldford of Drake University, also Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College with us, providing analysis on this day when the president is returning to Iowa in a couple of hours. It's the first time he's back on Iowa soil since the day before he was reelected in 2012. We're asking what you think of his new broadband initiative that will be outlined further this afternoon in his speech in Cedar Falls. Jason emails us, little will change for a large number of people so long as there are no alternatives. In our case, INS has a monopoly on the area, so long as there is price gouging. He says, in our case, we pay four times the cost of cable internet for the half the speed. That's Jason emailing. Our conversation always continuing on our Facebook page. When we come back, we'll discuss Senator Grassley's priorities now that he's taken over as chairman of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. What are you hoping he'll tackle? We'll lay out his priorities, get our reaction from Wayne Moyer and Dennis Goldford as well. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's Politics Wednesday on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College and Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Politics Wednesday. We like to dissect the latest in politics over the past few days. Today, as a matter of fact, we have President Obama in the state in a few hours describing an initiative that he is introducing to improve broadband access and holding Cedar Falls up with its access to the internet being offered through the Cedar Falls utilities. What do you think of this initiative, as we heard described by the press secretary, Josh Earnest, earlier, also in our newscast, 1-866-780-9100. A little later in the program, we would like your thoughts on the international and American reaction to the terrorist attacks in Paris 1 week ago. 1-866-780-9100. I want to mention, too, it's interesting. We posted on our Facebook page a link to the White House video, President Obama in the Oval Office talking about Cedar Falls. With his iPad on a bar graph there, Cedar Falls, right next to Hong Kong, right next to Seoul, South Korea. It's interesting viewing if you'd like to check out Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page for that link. With the GOP now in control of the Senate for the first time in 8 years, Iowa Republican Senator Charles Grassley has taken over chair of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee in this new Congress. Grassley, described by one notable recent political foe as a farmer from Iowa with no law degree, who never went to law school, who never practiced law, has in fact served on this committee for more than 30 years. Dennis Goldford, what do you expect with Senator Grassley at the helm of this committee?
Well, he does have a particular agenda that was detailed, I think, about a week or so ago in the Des Moines Register. First and foremost, he's got to oversee the confirmation of an attorney general. Attorney General Holder has resigned but is staying on until a new attorney general is confirmed, and the president has nominated Loretta Lynch. So we've got to get that done. And, of course, there are the usual vacant judgeships that have to be dealt with. So those are sort of – it's unusual to have an attorney general confirmed at this point, although people do lose the administration. But you always have judgeships to be filled. Oversight is something that Senator Grassley is concerned about with regard to judiciary-related matters. And that's something he's always been very good on, whether it's been a Democratic or Republican administration. We remember his – what was it? The $400 toilet seat or $400 hammer or something like that in the Pentagon. So he's always been very good about that. But things like immigration reform and juvenile justice reform and then more technical things like asset forfeitures, things like that, he's got an agenda in terms of taking a look at, and it involves to some extent trying to find a way to find some common ground with the White House.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if I'm looking at the priorities that he did give. The Des Moines Register printed them. They are given during a conference call with Iowa reporters and looking at the judge confirmations. Wayne Moyer, do you think that Grassley is signaling at all that confirmations will not be the holdup that it has been in the past, even though now the Senate is controlled by the GOP?
I think Grassley will move things along, but it will be interesting. Now the Republicans are in control of the Senate. Now, the Democrats did away with a filibuster on judge appointments, which means if the Republicans continue that, as I suspect that they will, that it will take 51 votes to confirm any judge. And there are more than 51 Republicans. So that means now that any judge that Obama appoints will probably have to have some Republican support. And the Democrats probably won't be able to block appointments.
When our representatives and senators get into high places, it's always talked about, Dennis, as the direct benefits to the state from where they come. Now, aside from prestige, does Senator Grassley, now chair of the Judiciary, bring Iowa any tangible benefits?
Well, it's not the same as being on the Ag Committee. I know Senator Grassley was in a position because of tremendous seniority. He's been in the Senate since January of 1981. He could have had his pick of several different committee chairmanships, but he and I had a conversation shortly after the election, and he talked about the various kinds of considerations in terms of if he didn't go for judiciary and waited for something else, he may not get it at the certain time. So I think he's always had judiciary interests, but it doesn't seem to me, unless I'm missing something, that there's something of direct relevance to Iowa per se, the mm-hmm. way, say, the Agricultural Committee would be.
You mentioned oversight in his conference call to reporters, to quote him, oversight, oversight, oversight. We haven't done a lot of oversight because I think the Democrat majority doesn't really want to investigate their own president. I don't mind investigating Republican presidents as well as Democrat presidents. It's my constitutional responsibility of oversight not to be political about it. Wayne Moyer, oversight, your comment on one of the stated Grassley priorities?
Well, my own sense is that that will be a strength of Grassley. I don't know what the implications for Iowa are, but he's likely to get quite a bit of publicity as a result of it.
Okay. Join our conversation as we talk now, moving to the political ramifications of the Paris attack 1 week ago. Remember, we were in the throes of that. I believe it had started this day last week and ended last Friday. Al-Qaeda in Yemen, if we look at our latest news, has claimed responsibility for the attack on the French satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo, saying it was ordered by the Islamic militant group's leadership for insulting the prophet Mohammed. This in a video posted to YouTube. Gunmen killing a total of 17 people in 3 days of violence in Paris. It began when they opened fire on Charlie Hebdo. It's the first time, though, with this news that this group officially claimed the attack, responsibility for the attack. I want to ask, Wayne, broadly speaking, what have you been looking at the last few days in terms of political repercussions and actions by player states in the world?
Well, I think the main thing that I think is important that has not got a lot of publicity is increased coordination between internal security people around the world. The president not being at the march on Sunday got a lot of publicity, much less publicity that Eric Holder was in fact in Paris coordinating with French security people. And so one thing that I think is positive coming out of this is the internal security people around the world are likely to be working much more closely together and better coordination of their activities to try to stop this sort of thing again in the future.
I want to go to a little bit of audio with an apology from the White House by Josh Earnest, the secretary, press secretary there. The White House admitting fault by not sending President Obama or Vice President Biden or another top-ranking official higher than the ambassador to France to the rally on Sunday in Paris, where more than 40 heads of state marched through Paris. Let's listen to what Josh Earnest had to say.
It's fair to say that we should have sent someone with a higher profile to be there. That said, there is no doubt that the American people and this administration stand four square behind our allies in France as they face down this threat.
Now, Josh Earnest did say it did not allow enough time to pull off. I mean, it's a tremendous security feat. I'm not really privy to the magnitude, but it is huge, of course, to get a president across the other side of the world with the necessary security where you're going to have millions of people gathering. How much damage by this misstep, Dennis Goldford?
I think relatively little. I mean, of course, you've already had Ted Cruz attacking the president about this, but, you know, Ted Cruz will attack the president for not using the right toothpaste. So it's something that's fodder to some extent domestically, but I don't think it's making a big difference in the world at large and in terms of working with allies.
Dennis, what questions are in your mind about how this continues to unfold politically and the U.S. reaction to it?
Well, you know, it has to do with the reaction of a lot of people who wanted, particularly the National Front in France and various kinds of conservative or nationalist groups in Germany, for example, who want in some way to impugn all Muslims with this kind of act. And to some extent, you always hear people saying, well, this is not Islam. Islam is a religion of peace. And I'm no theologian in this regard. But there was an interesting sign on a fellow at one of the demonstrations in Paris afterwards that said in French, "Not in my name." And you've got some folks in the Muslim community saying, you know, this don't do this in my name. This is not something a Muslim would really do. And so what's interesting to me is that there needs to be a sorting out among Muslims, and it's not mine to tell them how to do it at all, in terms of whether they embrace an action like this or reject an action like this. If they reject an action like this and really see that through, you know, they are the sea within which these kinds of folks who did these sorts of things swim. And so if you can dry that sea up, that'll make it a lot harder for them to act, and it'll be more efficient than anything we can do as a country.
Could I just add to that?
Wayne Moyer, yes, go ahead.
I think there is a problem with the word blasphemy as it is interpreted in the Muslim community. In large areas of the Muslim community, blasphemy or insulting the prophet or insulting religion is seen as a capital offense. And terrorists, people like we saw in Paris last week, can then sort of use religion, use this interpretation of blasphemy as a capital offense to justify actions such as they took in Paris. And so I think the Muslim community may need to think more in terms of how this word blasphemy is used and how people should react to it.
Wayne, what about comparing, and you too, Dennis, any observations comparing the way we in North America have dealt with our own terrorist attack, of course, 9/11 a good number of years ago now, and the way Europe has been in dealing with it. Do you notice any significant differences, interesting things to compare there, Wayne Moyer?
Well, 9/11 was such a shock to us my own sense is we overreacted, and to the extent that you think that the reason we started the war in Iraq in 2003 was in some sense a reaction to 9/11. I think the Europeans who've had terrorist attacks all along have been, at least up until now, had less of a tendency to overreact than we did to this. And our attack was undoubtedly the worst attack of all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm less worried about governments overreacting in Europe, although that's always a risk. But to talk something Dennis was talking about earlier, this might strengthen the right-wing National Front forces in Europe, which I think would be very undesirable.
So in reacting that Europe has is treated this also when we talk about other terrorist attacks, the London bombings, I think 2005 there, the Madrid train bombings, that it's seen as a police matter, Wayne, rather than a matter for conducting war?
I think it's been primarily a police matter, a big police matter, and sometimes involving use of troops, as France has called troops out to protect schools now, but mostly a police matter.
The problem with non-state actors is that they don't have an address. I mean, if it's a state actor, you know where to go find the people directing this. And when they're a non-state actor, you know, if the U.S. or even European countries, and France has participated in some of the bombing of ISIS facilities, they haven't had a specific address to know where precisely the people running things might be, to the extent there is any single person or group of persons running things.
We want to know what you think. What are your thoughts on the international and American reaction to the terrorist attacks in Paris that was going on 1 week ago? 1-866-780-9100, river2river@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. I'm looking at a couple of polls that the Pew Research Center has put out on terrorism. Last week's attack was the most closely followed news in the U.S. last week, the Paris attack. But it's interesting that interest in the story was not as high when compared with previous terrorist incidents abroad, the London bombings 2005, remember the Chechen rebels assaulting a Russian school in 2004, the Madrid bombings that killed 191. About a third of us Americans, according to this poll, followed last week's attack closely. Wayne, is this a sign that perhaps we've accepted periodic terrorist attacks as our present and our future?
There may be some element of that, but I think the main thing operating here is a terrorist attack abroad almost inevitably attracts less attention than a terrorist attack at home. We might compare terrorist attacks abroad 10 years ago with terrorist attacks abroad today, but I think it's bad to compare terrorist attacks abroad with terrorist attacks inside the United States.
In the aftermath of these attacks, too, there has been, according to another Pew poll, little change in the public's worries about an imminent terrorist attack in the United States. In addition, the public gives high ratings to the U.S. government's anti-terrorism efforts. 7 in 10 saying the government is doing very well or fairly well in reducing the threat of terrorism. So terrorism as a political issue, Dennis, where do you see it going?
Well, it was politicized certainly in the 2002 election, the first election after 9/11. But, the first duty of government is arguably national defense and domestic tranquility. It's preserving the peace and making sure people don't come to harm. And nobody wants to be in charge when another terrorist action of whatever sort from whatever group succeeds. So it will always be a political issue. There will always be a blame game afterwards. And it's become, unfortunately, part of the world we live in.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about, Dennis, what about religious attitudes in the U.S. and how they might differ from those in France and the view on this attack?
Well, you know, the U.S. is a very religious country and by all polls, much more than Western European countries. Some writers of a more conservative bent refer to Western Europe as post-Christian in certain ways. But you have an interesting situation in France, for example. France has always been, because it was so clerical before the French Revolution, because the Catholic Church was so much involved with the powers that be, there's been an anti-clericalism ever since, and there's been a clerical, anti-clerical dimension to a lot of French politics. But you have a situation, they've banned, the burqa or covering the face or something like that, and we haven't done that.
For security reasons.
Right.
You cannot identify a person whose face is covered.
Right, and I've walked into banks in this country where they say if you come into this bank, you can't wear a hoodie,
right,
because they want to be able to see your face. But France is in the situation. Interestingly, they have both the largest Jewish population in Western Europe and the largest Muslim population in Western Europe. Now, the Muslim population of France is 5 million. The Jewish population is 500,000. So it's a tenfold difference. But they're caught particularly in that circumstance, and that makes things a lot more difficult for them than so far we seem to have it here.
Before we close out this hour, let's go to our caller, Joe, in Fort Dodge. Joe, you've been listening. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I've been listening. I kind of a unique perspective. I worked in Germany back in 1985, actually, when it was West Germany. The first day I was at work, there was a bomb went off at the international airport in Frankfurt within hours of me picking up my boss. And then I was in another location where I was a block away from an Esso station that got blown up. And I just don't remember those things making the news. And I think they were much more common in Europe in the 80s. And I just wonder, you know, what do you think of that? Or do we make too much of these things now?
Yeah, I think that was more terrorism from radical groups in Germany. The Bader-Meinhof gang, mm-hmm, it comes in mind. Maybe you know more about that, Dennis, than I do. But these were fascists or what?
Mm-hmm. Well, you had ETA like in the Basque country, and
right,
you also had the Irish Republican Army. So, you know, I mean, Europe has been through this a bit more than we have. Do you think that changes the perspective?
Wayne, I'm not sure who wants to jump in. Wayne Moyer?
Yeah, I think the fact that the Europeans have had more of it, and I think this was a point I was trying to make earlier, means that more measured reaction with each additional terrorist incident. One thing I think is positive about the polls, though, is that the U.S. concern about terrorism did not go suddenly up after this attack in Paris. And that, and if they're confident about government efforts to deal with terrorism, that indicates to me that we're less likely to overreact in this situation than we were after 9/11, for instance.
I wonder, Dennis, if you can comment quickly before we have to go. Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel was at this march in Paris on Sunday, though there was a desire expressed by the French government that he not be there.
Right. They wanted to keep that separate from the Palestinian issue. And interestingly, if you remember some of the video from that, he was down the line from Mr. Abbas, who's the head of the Palestinian Authority. So that was an interesting visual. But I think Netanyahu, of course, he's up for re-election at this point, so he's got those domestic politics. But the basic argument, I think, on Netanyahu's point was simply, look, what this is what we've been living with for a long, long time, and none of us should have to live this way. And we've been the ones yelling, look out for these folks, and you haven't paid a lot of attention to us, and now it's hit you at home, and maybe you'll pay attention now.
So Netanyahu wanting to make it one struggle rather than the struggle that he sees of Israel against terrorism and the rest of the world in other fights.
Yeah, I think he's not trying to make it one struggle. He's saying it is one struggle. You all need to realize that.
Mm-hmm. As we close, Wayne Moyer, any thoughts looking forward?
Well, I think at least in terms of the terrorist incident, that I, as a result of what happened in London or in Paris, that we're likely to be better prepared for the next incident.
Mm-hmm. And the last word to you, Dennis Goldford.
I hope that's the case.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University, Flansburg Fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement in our Des Moines studio. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College, two of our regular political analysts that join us on Wednesday. Tomorrow on this program, I'll be off. My colleague Ben Stanton will be sitting in for me. Dennis and Wayne, it's been a pleasure having you on. Thank you both.
Very
welcome.
Always
a pleasure.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. John Pemble helped us out in Des Moines. Also, a big thanks to Pat Blank for helping us out with that Josh Earnest interview a little bit earlier. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.